Women Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge introduces incredible stories shared by women across the globe who have experienced the great heights of success and, at times, the agony of defeat. With a vision to impart wisdom and advice on how to tackle barriers and soar to new heights, the show uncovers different perspectives to help you find your inner strength and to power up your own voice so you can excel in life.
Welcome to Women Worldwide. I'm your host, Deirdre Breckenridge. Let's kick this episode off with a focus on personalization. Why is it important today? Does personalization give you a better shopping experience? Do you feel like you gravitate to companies that make you feel like they understand you and know your preferences? All right, I'm just going to admit my bias up front, and nobody pays me to say this. I receive my clothes out of a box every single month. I go to an online site. I signed up. I have a personal stylist who picks my clothing that fits my personality. It's all based on my past preferences and what I've shared about my style habits and what I really like. Okay, so now let me introduce my special guest today, who has a lot to say about personalization and retail tech. Her name is Michelle Bacharach, and she is the co-founder and CEO of Find Mine, which is an enterprise SaaS startup positioned to make retail more efficient and your shopping more delightful. Michelle, it's great to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, okay. So we have a lot to talk about when it comes to personalization and retail tech. But you know what? You have an interesting background because you transitioned from entertainment, I believe you were at Univision, to retail tech. So tell us why and how you made that switch.
Yeah, that's a great question. So ever since I was my first job out of college, I've been involved somehow in product management. And what that means is the people who kind of figure out and define what user experiences you're going to be having when interacting with a technology or a service via a website or an app or any kind of digital experience. And so product managers tend to be very obsessed with customer experience and their how they're getting from point A to point B, whether that's reading multiple articles on a website or watching multiple videos or buying products. And so when I was at Univision, I was in a corporate strategy role, and then I was on the product team and constantly being attuned to helping our customers who were, you know, viewers of Univision content accomplish what they were looking for. So, you know, watching the videos that they wanted to as quickly as possible, finding everything that they were looking for and having a good experience doing it. Well, and meanwhile, in my personal life as a consumer and as a shopper, I was experiencing this friction constantly where I would buy something and then I'd get it home and I'd be like, well, wait a minute, now I have to put an app together around it. And, you know, I don't know how to do that. And looking on Pinterest or going on Google and Googling how to wear a leather skirt. And it was adding all this extra work to my journey. And so having that kind of allergy to a very experience full of friction was a frustration point for me. And that's what drew me to start this company.
Oh, that is really cool because, you know, if you think about it, I can definitely relate to Googling how to wear certain things, what is this big scarf and what's the best way it's going to look around my neck. Just that having somebody who can be there or to be able to be online to have those recommendations and to help you makes the difference. So that kind of leads into the importance question. You know, getting into your retail tech, you know, did you realize early on through you, did you do studies around it? You know, what made you see that personalization, you know, it's so important today?
That's a great question. So I was having this kind of friction in my shopping experience and I wondered, hey, I wonder if anyone else is having this. And I did some research and I found that actually there's 600 million questions getting asked every day about how to use the products in our lives, because often we're buying one individual product and it's not just fashion. It could be a couch. And now we have to figure out what rug and end table and lamp will go with the couch. Maybe it's a drone at Best Buy. And you have to figure out what, you know, replacement propeller blades are going to be compatible with that drone. Maybe you have a baby and you have to figure out what model of stroller is going to fit the car seat attachment that you bought for it, and you know, not everything just fits together. And so I started realizing, hey, this is a big opportunity. A lot of people have these kinds of questions, and the retailer is not really equipped to give you these answers. You'll see a mannequin in a window display, or you'll see maybe a lookbook online. But what's happening is they're having to manually create those, first of all, which means that they can't create a unique outfit for a unique mannequin for every single person that comes to their stores. Virtually, physically impossible. So they need some kind of automation technology to help with that, to help answer each individual person's questions in a scalable fashion.
So is that, so that's really the basis behind your company. Is that what Find Mine does and how it helps with personalization?
Exactly. So we take an individual product and we put it in the set of products that make sense for it. And so if you imagine a white t-shirt, so a white t-shirt you can wear 1,000 different ways, a million different ways maybe. So what we try to filter down on the ways in which a white t-shirt should be worn according to the brand. So, for example, Rag & Bone has a different view of how you should wear a white t-shirt than Forever 21 does. So we narrow it down by that, and then we try to narrow it down by which of those ways that this particular brand, you know, envisions you wearing a white t-shirt makes sense for you, the shopper, given how many items you have in your cart at the time you're checking out, what we've known you bought before, where you live, what the climate's like where you are, so that the outfit that is being prescribed to you not only is on brand for the retailer and is something, you know, aspirational and, you know, admirable for them to have you wear, but also makes sense for your own taste and wardrobe and you're really likely to buy it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it definitely has to be what you like, what you prefer. And that would be based on if somebody is a part of this type of retail experience, is it, you know, I'm just trying to kind of shape the machine learning. Is it the machine learning that's gathering all of this information so every time they go back, it gives more to their style and preference?
Exactly. So our system basically takes in a retailer's product catalog and does this grouping. So in fashion, we group everything into outfits. And then the retailer uses that to show the customer full outfits on like the product page when you're shopping online. So if you're on that white t-shirt page, you'll see three different outfits you can wear with that white t-shirt. So you as the shopper are interacting with Find Mine essentially through your favorite store that uses Find Mine, and they're just showing you the outfits that make sense for them and make sense for you very seamlessly. So we're not asking you a bunch of questions. You don't have to take a quiz about your style. We're picking up on those attributes about you from much more subtle ways about, you know, what you have in your shopping cart, what you've clicked on before, other data points that we can gather about you to narrow down the experience to make it tailored to you. It's kind of like having your own subscription box of clothes show up at your house, but instead of receiving this, you know, box every month that you don't have a lot of input in, you're choosing what items go in that box from your favorite stores the way you normally shop every day.
Wow, this is, it's really, sounds like it's very advanced and can truly make a great shopping experience. Do you, you know, looking at your industry and what you're doing, are you finding that more companies are providing this experience, or, you know, do you even see this in other industries? Is this something that people are familiar with and businesses understand, or you're at the cusp of what you're doing is really ahead of your time and companies will learn by what you're doing?
I mean, everyone understands personalization and the importance of it. I mean, if you think about Netflix and how they recommend the next show you should watch, or if you think about Amazon and they show you, based on the dog food you bought, we think you might also like these golf clubs. Well, dog food and golf clubs are not related at all, but they picked up on some attributes about your personality that say you might be in a cohort with other people who really like these, this set of golf clubs based on the kind of dog they have. Who knows? So I think everyone really understands the power of personalization in that sense. What we're doing that's different is we say, okay, we know that tailoring a custom experience to the shopper is critical. But instead of just saying, because you like this pair of shoes, you'll like this headband, doesn't necessarily mean you'll wear them together at the same time. So we're trying to cross-reference on what is actually fashionable and what's an outfit, a full outfit that you're likely to want based on not only the parameters of your personality and your taste, but also what is this store's vision for how you should be wearing that clothes? What is their taste? So it's that intersection between those two things to help you answer the question, what do I do with it now? Once I've got this product, how do I wear it in an outfit or furniture? You know, how do I decorate my apartment around it? How do I plug stuff into it that's going to be compatible, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, that speaks to so many different needs. And I mean, when I think about consumers, and maybe you have the more of the details, what is the consumer who would definitely want to have this experience? Is there a certain demographic, or is it everybody? And who is the most prominent group?
And that's a great question, and one I kind of struggled with initially when building this business. So I thought, okay, well, maybe, you know, fashionistas don't need this because they already can, they can see any product and envision exactly how they want to wear it right at the outset. But then I started talking to people and realizing, well, hey, you know, fashionistas actually like this kind of a experience as well too, because maybe we're presenting them with an outfit they never would have thought of. So it's essentially just adding inspiration to the pile of possibility. And then it's also for the customer who's not a fashionista, it's still frictionless. It's making that, answering that question, okay, I like this t-shirt, but how am I going to wear it in an outfit? It's taking steps out of the process for them, so it's saving them time. And in a world where we have millions and millions of choices, especially when we're shopping online, we don't have the time to look through every single thing. So saving time is so much more important than ever. So I think it really is consumers on both ends of that spectrum, the ones who really geek out on shopping and want to spend as much time as possible because they're creating inspiration and additional right. information. And then the customers who just want to get in and get out and get their shopping list checked off.
Yeah, I think that would be me. So what about men versus women? Is it a woman who is more likely to enjoy this, or would men find this beneficial as well? Because they clearly would, I would think, would be in that category of, let me just get in and get out and get this done.
Again, that was a really surprising answer for us. I mean, one of our marquee customers and someone who we really added a ton of value to their business is John Varvatos, which is a luxury menswear brand. And I thought, okay, well, maybe men don't really think about things in terms of outfits. Maybe they have much more, you know, men's clothing, you have a much more narrow set of choices. It's not this infinite sea of possibility that women have. It's, you know, much more straightforward. But we've seen a tremendous increase in sales from working with John Varvatos. We've achieved for them, you know, over 100% increase in conversion rate because we've been showing the customer, hey, here's three outfits you can wear, this slightly edgy, you know, fairly aspirational in terms of price leather jacket. And so we're empowering that man to say yes to that leather jacket he might not otherwise have, because now he can see, oh, you know what, I'll actually get a lot of use out of this. Or maybe add a couple items to his cart in addition. So I think the behavior maybe is a little bit different in terms of, you know, helping push men outside their comfort zone a little bit more. But I think there's certainly value for both men's and women's apparel. And we've seen that play out with our customers and the results we've been able to get for them.
What about, it's really interesting about men. Do you find any differences between younger and older generations? So are, you know, millennials, would they fit the profile of somebody who would take advantage of the personalization offered through FindMine? Or is it the more seasoned, older shopper?
Yeah, I think that we haven't explicitly studied it by age group, and that's a really good point. We're gathering more data on that now so we can do exactly that analysis. But what I've understood from kind of qualitative conversations with, you know, customers and customer shoppers in those different age groups is that, you know, millennials sort of expect personalized experiences now.
Oh, yeah.
It is just the price of admission for anything, a retailer, a entertainment site, online, you know, newspaper. And then for the older generation who might be dabbling in online shopping more than they ever had before, can be super overwhelmed because maybe they're used to, you know, shopping at their favorite site, which was tightly curated, but then they heard about a site that aggregates a whole bunch of stores and is like an online mall. Well, now you have a million products at your fingertips and you're overwhelmed as to how do you experience this. So I think that both age groups definitely benefit from it, but they're looking for a slightly different thing.
Got it. And how are you getting the word out about FindMine? You know, how are you connecting with these retailers, and how are even consumers understanding, you know, what you're doing, and is there an education process?
Mm-hmm. Well, so as a B2B company, we really don't need the consumer to know about us. For most of our customers, it's white labeled, and so you don't actually see that FindMine is powering this complete the look experience, except in certain cases.
So you're kind of like the Intel inside.
Yeah, exactly. We're the machine behind the scenes. But that said, we have been fortunate to get a lot of exposure in the retail tech community. So I gave one of the closing kind of TED-style talks at the National Retail Federation Conference, which was an audience of 2,000 retail executives. And that was in January of this year. And we've had a lot of press in the retail tech space. And people have kind of reached out to us through our website, you know, cold emailed us. We have a lot of partners who we're working with who constantly are referring us to potential customers. And then also we've had some somewhat, you know, general market press as well, where the story is a little bit different because we're coming at it from the shopper's point of view. And the shopper can then get directed to one of our customer sites to shop and experience FindMine through our customer's, you know, store.
Well, that's really interesting. And are you finding, because you sort of made this switch from the entertainment into the, you know, tech space and startup, what is that like personally for you? The whole venture, is it, do you find the tech startup life more invigorating? Is it more difficult?
Definitely busier.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, the difference really isn't moving from like entertainment to technology or entertainment to retail. It's moving from a large corporation to a startup. And in fact, I worked at a startup before. I worked at Univision, but I was employee number 8 and we grew to 20. So it was very different than like starting this in my apartment, you know, nights and weekends while I was still working on a full-time job. I would say that now that I've done this, like I need a really long vacation when it's over, but I also don't know any other way now. Like, I can't imagine having a job in a huge organization where I'm only a small piece of the equation, because I've really enjoyed just like architecting everything from the bottom up, just from the most, you know, silly detail very early on to the broadest vision to what the culture should be internally at our company. So I think I'm going to want to do that again and again.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, there is no turning back in many cases, because once you do get that taste of what you can build, and especially the culture, I'm sure you experience, or anybody who is at a startup and then probably goes to a big corporation, that is culture shock. And it could even be culture shock from the corporation into the startup as well.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. I've experienced it in both directions. And I think that, you know, at a big company, you have all of the resources in the world, but decision-making is hard. And in a startup, you have all the decision-making power in the world, but resources are strapped. So you kind of are stuck from in the same, you know, in the same or in a different way in both situations. It's kind of funny.
Well, it sounds like you're happy in your tech startup world. So I'm just going to ask you to hold any more thoughts. We're going to cut to a quick break, give some love to our sponsor. And in the next segment, Michelle's going to share her ups and downs as a woman in tech and what makes a winning team.
You have been listening to Women Worldwide with your host, Deirdre Breckenridge. Segment 2 is coming right up.
Creating brand loyalty requires a unique blend of strategic communications and innovative technology. Pure Performance Communications works with businesses to move their audiences from interest to action, giving you a roadmap that fosters deeper engagement and forges stronger relationships along the way. Visit us at pureperformance.com. Thank you.
Now, back to Women Worldwide with your host, Deirdre Breckenridge.
I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. Welcome back to the show. I've been chatting with Michelle Bacharach, CEO and co-founder of FindMine. So, Michelle, you were just saying how great it was to be a startup an owner in the tech space. So you are truly now a woman in tech. So of course that begs the question, how easy or how difficult has that been for you?
So that's an interesting question, because when I started my career, I was at a startup where my boss was a woman, the CEO was a woman, the founder was a woman, and the head of technology was a woman. I didn't even realize that it was, you know, a challenge or that there was a gender inequality in the technology industry until much later. Now that I'm a female founder, I definitely noticed, you know, going to events, I'm like, where are all the women? I went to an event on Friday, and it was like me and four other women and, you know, probably 100 guys. So it's sort of this weird feeling of like, oh, I'm in the minority all of a sudden, and I notice it in a very palpable way. Sometimes it's completely benign and it doesn't, you know, affect the outcome of whatever's happening in any negative way. But I've definitely experienced a lot of times trying to explain, especially my business, which has so much to do with shopping and fashion and things that I guess traditionally, quote unquote, a woman's domain. And then, you know, especially male investors, and they'll be like, oh, let me ask my wife about this and see what she thinks. I'm like, what? Oh. You don't have your own opinion on this? Like,
I know, right?
It's really kind of shocking.
That is totally shocking. Well, I love that you started out in an environment where every single leader in the company was a woman, so that you kind of feel like, oh, why should it be any different? So that's a great start. But yeah, I mean, I would think that you would come across times in the boardroom. Is because you are a woman, because your company is around shopping, which could, you know, be a quote unquote woman's topic, which we know it isn't. Are you taken seriously? Are you finding as you go along that, you know, things are getting better constantly?
Yeah, I would say, especially because we're based in New York, the gender distribution is much more equal here. And it's, I think, getting better every day with a lot of initiatives like Girls Who Code, scholarships and things like that to help women start their own companies, but more women investors who are getting involved. So I do think it's changing. It's getting easier. And it's getting, you know, people are having more comfort speaking up about inequality. So I had a friend who, couple of friends actually. So one organizes an event where he has a bunch of women founders come pitch, you know, regardless of gender.
He
said, oh, I've had a hard time finding, you know, female founders to come pitch. And one of my other friends who's in the audience, like, called him out on it. They got in an argument, kind of just like healthy debate right there on the spot. And she's like, I have, you know, 1,000 different female founders in my network I can introduce you to. So like, I think maybe a few years ago, they wouldn't even have that conversation. And so the fact they even had it is amazing. And the other thing is the fact that this female founder friend of mine is in all these communities. So these communities have sprung up everywhere. But now the challenge is like, you know, men aren't really allowed in these communities. And so we can't really get mad at them for not knowing they exist, because it's a girl only club.
Involved.
They're not invited.
Right.
So we have to now take it on ourselves to make sure that all the, you know, male players in this ecosystem know that these exist, and if they're looking for female founders, where to find them.
Well, you know, I had on the show, I guess it was a few weeks ago, Jack Myers, who wrote a really, really good book called The Future of Men. And, you know, in his book, he was saying the importance of women, who the power is shifting toward women, who now are taking, you know, larger roles in the corporation, on the C-level, they're in politics. And as younger men are kind of getting into the organizations, more organizations are recognizing women. And there are, you know, people are mentoring women, and there are associations, and whether it's clubs or ways for women to get involved, you need that same level of inclusion for men as well, so that they're in it together. So I think that's what you were kind of speaking toward.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just, you know, we don't have to invite men into our female founders groups, because there's the reason why we need to leg up. We need to help each other, because we've been in a one down position in the past. So this is kind of leveling the playing field. But that said, we should make sure that they know about these resources. They know that you know, female founders are gathering in these places. And if ever they see a panel with, you know, all men on it talking about anything startup related, let alone like gender equality, they say, hey, wait a minute, like, why aren't there women on this panel? That we need to empower the men in the community as well to speak up and say, you know what, like, I think that this needs to be a more gender balanced situation, whatever the situation might be.
Absolutely. So let's take it into the kind of startup and startup life. You know, you put a team together so that you can, of course, launch your company and create a great experience, bring all these retailers in so consumers can have a great experience. What is it on the inside for you that creates a really good winning tech team?
From the technical perspective, I would say you need people who are really passionate about what they do, and you need people who can pull themselves out of the weeds. So especially with a small team, you know, I've worked in big companies managing teams of developers and, you know, QA engineers, designers, things like that. And in a big company, you can get away with a little more where each person can be so deeply specialized, they don't have to, you know, be able to think about the big picture. But in a startup, you don't have that luxury. You really have to make sure even your technical team can look at the, why are we building this? They can't allow themselves to get fixated on, you know, the how without forgetting about the why. And that, I think, is a really hard skill to screen for. And I think it's a really hard skill to find in a lot of engineers because nature of computer software development is very attention to detail oriented. It's really technical and very nitty gritty. And so finding people who can pull themselves up and look at the big picture of the, you know, goals of the company and the goals of the business is very rare. But we've been really lucky so far in finding people who have kind of those skills. And I think maybe it's because of their backgrounds. Their backgrounds are very diverse. We have two team members who've been in the military, one in the U.S. Air Force, one in the Israeli Defense Force. We have a team member who worked at, you know, a large corporation and also at a startup and has gone back to school. So I think diversity of experience and the background is a good proxy to finding people who have both that technical, deep, detailed ability, but also the big picture stuff.
Yeah, no, that would be really important. And, you know, I guess they have to come with certain skills and they definitely have interesting backgrounds. And probably the work dynamic and the culture that you've built lends its hand to people more and more being able to pull themselves out of the weeds and to be really connected as well as passionate and all of the other characteristics that you mentioned. So it sounds like you have a winning team, no doubt about it. You know, you are an entrepreneur, which we said before was very different than corporate life. So why don't you maybe flesh out a little bit more, describe what makes you different as a startup owner?
I would say that because I have not only the background in corporate, but a background in startups as an early employee, gives me a really good perspective because I think if you come from a corporate environment only and then go to work in a startup, you might not be sensitive enough to the plight of the early startup employee because you never experienced that. And so having been an early startup employee, I know how my employees would want to be treated or what not to do and, you know, how to make them feel part of the team, like they actually are making a difference here, and not overburden them, helping them teach them work-life balance and things like that. Whereas if you come from a corporate background only, you know, you're struggling with the difference in work-life balance that you had as compared to the corporation. So you're not even like thinking about your employees and how they're handling it necessarily. So I think that's kind of one of my secret weapons is like, I remember what it was like being an early employee, so I can help craft the culture that an early employee would want. I would say that's like maybe a main differentiator for me. And then also having a product management background. I know a lot of founders start companies without a technical or product background. And I've seen them do great things, but I definitely think they have to work a lot harder to make up a lot of ground. And I already had that in my career kind of toolkit, which was nice.
That's great to have that built in. I also really like that you have that empathy and compassion for the startup employee, because like you said, you sort of have to walk in somebody's shoes in order to understand what they're going through in the environment. And when you can do that, you build the right culture and you can build that winning team. So your whole life, it sounds like, is a lot of technology, which you love. If your business is technology, then how do you ever break away from technology?
That's a good question. I'm still struggling with that. I used to, and I've fallen off the wagon a little bit, have a no devices before, or after 10 p.m. rule, where I had to be off the computer, off the phone, no looking, scrolling through Facebook in bed endlessly, because it just helped me unwind. I've been a little bad recently. My new rule is now no politics after 10 p.m. because I find that really riles me up, and then I can't.
Oh my gosh, me too. Oh boy, maybe that's a different show.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Yeah. I'll be happy when this election is over, just
me
regardless,
too.
Because I can get my life back. But
by any chance finding like cable news is constantly on? I think that's one of my problems. I'm always Googling for the headlines. From my smartphone and the apps to whether it's, NBC, MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, to what I do on Google, to then watching those shows. Oh my gosh, my brain is just spinning. It's kind of hard to go to sleep.
It's information overload. And what I found actually is interesting, I mean, I don't have a cable, so I'm literally in an echo chamber of personalization's creation. Like all my Facebook has noticed what I've been clicking on, so they only serve me that. So I'm only hearing my own opinion reiterated back at me a million times, which I think is really a disservice in this political climate to not hear what the other side of the table has to say, because it makes it so much easier to, draw lines and call someone else an other when really you have more in common with them than you have not in common with them. So I think that that's kind of exacerbated my, revolves into tech after a certain time at night. Although sometimes it's hard to put the computer away if there's still work to be done. So I try to make up for it on the other side by maybe doing yoga in the morning if I feel
late
working on something. Yeah.
Yeah. I meditate in the morning, so I can relate to that. Just do yourself a favor. Don't be watching those hashtags on Hootsuite.
Yes, exactly.
I have them all carved out and they go by so quickly and drive you crazy. You never get to sleep. So what do you think you've learned from your experience as a tech startup founder that you really want to share with other aspiring entrepreneurs?
My favorite bits of advice so far that I like to pass on are, first of all, just don't die.
Yes.
Find a way to keep your startup alive as long as possible, because there was probably six or seven different points in time when we were like, that's it, company over, and we just had to hold on for another month or 6 weeks, and some amazing change of fortune came our way and kept us in business. So, just be a cockroach. I think that's the new goal for startups these days is being a cockroach, not being a unicorn, because those ones are the ones who can weather these tough times that we're in. Another piece of startup advice I have is, keep a life. You'll be more productive and more successful in your startup the more of a rich life and friendships and, family, community cultivate outside of work. It's hard because you don't have that many hours, but you're diminishing returns from the hours that you're productive at work if you're not rejuvenating yourself with your, loved ones and doing the things that you love, your hobbies. You can't forget who you are outside of a startup, because it can be very tempting to do that. And so in fact, we've been talking about vacation policy, which we don't have one. It's sort of just flexible, and as long as you get your work done, you go on vacation. But I was thinking that when we formalize it, it could be that we require employees to take at least 1 week of completely disconnected, you know, mini sabbatical. Like, you are not allowed to be on your computer. And if you do, then you will get docked, you know, some other kind of fun bonus. Like, you can't participate in Ice Cream Thursdays if you check email on your vacation. Because I really do think that human beings weren't wired to work the way we're working now, and it's detrimental to our productivity. So that's my other big piece of advice. Just don't lose who you are outside the startup.
That's a really, really good idea. And I think that employees, as much as they say, I'll take that vacation, especially if they have the entrepreneurial spirit, it's hard to break away. So if you mandate it, you might actually let it happen. But I didn't want to interrupt you. You're on a flow of your best advice.
Yeah, I don't think I had a third one.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure. So it was don't die. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And what was it? It's be a cockroach and not a unicorn.
Not a unicorn. Then, well, you can be a unicorn too, but you have to be a cockroach first, I think.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Be a cockroach first. When you were talking about kind of making sure that you pursued some of your hobbies, what are some of your hobbies, if you don't mind sharing?
I mentioned yoga already. That's a big one. I was an actress at one point in a former life, so I still really enjoy performing, and improv is another hobby I have. Haven't had a ton of time for that. It's harder to dabble in improv. You kind of have to be on a team and like doing it consistently, whereas you can sort of dabble in yoga. I also do like a cardio dance class. Some friends of mine, it's like, it's called 305 Fitness. It's like being in a Miami nightclub, but working out. So there's a live DJ and a laser light show, and you're doing like high knee runs and then some like cool hip hop moves back to back. And it's like an hour of just intense cardio sweat, but it's super fun.
Holy cow. Doing that. How many times a week do you do that?
Oh, like once a week. If I go more than once a week, I'm just toast. Like my feet will hurt all the time.
Wow, that sounds really intense.
Yeah, oh my goodness. It's awesome. The first time I went, I couldn't walk for like a week, but after that I was hooked. So
if you can get past the first week, it's okay then.
Yeah. In fact, they do a 2-for-1 special. So they like make you come back. I mean, not make you, but they encourage you to come back. If you come back the second time, like you're good.
Oh, that's good. And then just curious, with everything that you're doing, who's your inspiration? You know, where does all of this come from? Was there somebody in your past who inspired you to take the technology route? Somebody in your family, a motivational speaker, you know, a business person? Who is it?
So both my parents are self-employed. My dad has like a software consulting business, and he's, you know, an entrepreneur in that sense, but more of a small business than like a, you know, tech startup. But I was never really interested in technology through him. Although maybe my comfort level with it was higher because he will go to his work and, you know, the terminal was like the black screen and the green type. So I was like just around that all the time. And my mom is a therapist and licensed clinical social worker. So she maintains her own schedule. She has her own set of clients. And so just that lifestyle, I always kind of watched them adjust things depending on what they had going on, or like take on more, you know, patients if they wanted to make a little more money this month. And having that flexibility was like, that makes sense. Like, that makes more sense actually than this like 9-to-5 thing. So maybe that's where I kind of got the idea for controlling my own destiny, so to speak.
Yeah, if you grow up with that and you see it, I could definitely see how that could happen. Although for me, I didn't see my parents. They were both in education, although I will say that as a result of their deep ties to education, that's why I'm a, you know, adjunct professor today. Mm-hmm. So whatever you experience when you're growing up definitely plays a part. Last personal question. What is your favorite book?
Ooh. Such a hard question. I always default to like the one I read most recently. Because I have a terrible memory. Actually, I have a list of all the books I've read, so I don't forget what I've read. And I don't have it in front of me right now. So I'm going to say the most recent book I read, which is called Quiet. the subtitle is The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking.
Oh,
and it's about introverts. I don't really like fiction, but the last fiction I read was Harry Potter, which I was obsessed with. But okay. I really like nonfiction because it's sort of like for personal development purposes. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm getting so much more bang for my buck. And this book, Quiet, is about introverts and the model of leadership that comes with introverts. And I am definitely an introvert. I might not seem like it because I'm not shy. I'm outspoken. I'm a public speaker. Don't get nervous around groups of people. But the definition of introvert that they use is that, you know, you're tired after a day of interacting with other people, and you need to be alone to recharge your battery, whereas an extrovert recharges their battery around other people. So it's really interesting in terms of like the model of leadership that we're used to, which is this brash, usually male, kind of outspoken CEO type. But time and again, the introverts are the better leaders when they kind of actually come down to looking at performance.
Oh, that sounds like a really good book. I'm going to have my husband's in tech. It's The Power of Introverts, and what was the sub?
The main title is called Quiet.
Quiet, that's it.
And the subtitle is The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, or something
excellent.
Like that.
Yes, and we are certainly in a world that cannot stop talking. Okay, so last question, super easy. How can my audience find out more about you and find mine?
Sure. Well, so I'm Michelle Harrison Bacharach on LinkedIn. I'm My Michelle on Twitter, MyMeeShell. And then FindMine is findmine.com. That's FindMine.com. And we are on Twitter at FindMineUS.
Awesome. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your career journey, what's going on in retail tech, personalization, and just life as an entrepreneur. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on.
Anytime. And I also want to thank all of you for tuning into Women Worldwide. Until our next episode, stay focused, energized, and feeling empowered. Thank you.
You have been listening to Women Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge, brought to you by Pure Performance Communications on the socialnetworkstation.com. You can reach Pure Performance at www.pureperformancecom.com. Women Worldwide is produced by SNI, and the opinions of the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect those of Social Network Intermedia, LLC, or the Social Network Station.